welcome back, everybody. It's time again for another episode of Church Hurts. And the good, the bad, and the ugly about church, religion, and spirituality today. With a dash of recovery thrown in along the way. So if you've ever had your own questions about your own church, maybe become a bit jaded to the whole subject of religion itself, hey, you've come to the right place. Because today our show is entitled Clean, Sober, and Wonderful. Let's bring in our wonderful host. He was a philosophy honors student, ordained a Presbyterian minister. He even planted a few churches along the way. But now, he's just wonderfully asking the same question, wandering the world. Why? Why not bring him in, the host of her church, and Dr. John Bash? Welcome, sir.
165,148. That's how many deaths from COVID-19 to this exact moment in the United States. Everything in life has changed, and we live in fear and shock from this once-in-a-lifetime pandemic. 67,367. That's how many people died from drug overdoses in 2018. 70,237 was the number of the year earlier. Wait, I'm talking about annual numbers here, not a one-time pandemic. It doesn't take many years for these numbers to far exceed the deaths from COVID-19. It's simply breathtaking. The opioid epidemic, quote, is devastating America. Overdoses have passed car crashes and gun violence to become the leading cause of death for Americans under 55. The epidemic has killed more people than HIV at the peak of the disease, and its death toll exceeds those of the wars in Vietnam and Iraq combined. Funerals for young people have become common. Every 11 minutes, another life is lost. So why do so many people start using these drugs? Why don't they just stop? That was the beginning of an article in the New York Times in December 2018 entitled A Visual Journey Through Addiction. One young woman described her drug use with the words, "It's like being hugged by Jesus." Reality is that until one's life is personally touched by drug abuse, it really is just another sad statistic. It's like hearing about a war on the other side of the world compared to feeling a bomb going off in your backyard. Why pay attention? Why care? So today we're going to bring it a little closer to home than I'd prefer. We're going to talk to a young Orange County woman who's worked in almost every aspect of the recovery industry in the past 10 years. And yes, it is an industry. Her credentials? Really, her credentials are mainly found in the story behind her resume. Growing up, she excelled on the soccer field, her blonde ponytail bouncing behind her as she sped by the opposing team, juggling the ball as if she was born with it. Her laughter and joy filled the field. She was a preacher kid, too. Going to church every Sunday for 4 hours and a few times during the week. I bet you feel it coming, don't you? Caitlin Ann, welcome to Church Hurts. Ann.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Caitlin, our listeners are pretty smart people and they know what's coming. So let's just dive to your bottom. What was life like at the end of your drug use? Give me the picture.
Okay, so there's been a couple. But at the end of my drug use, one time, I was in a motel room in Costa Mesa. I had no idea that I was in Costa Mesa. And I was strung out on heroin and crack.
In a motel room. For how long?
In a motel room. I couldn't give you a complete honest answer, but I believe a month and a half.
Wow. And where did anybody in your life know where you were?
Yeah. So the two people I was with were both my drug dealers. So I was in a motel room with two of my drug dealers, and I did not want my friends to know exactly where I was or my family. So those were the only two people that really knew.
Now, okay. We started, as you said, when we talk about bottoms, and you said there were a few of them, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit in terms of what that really means about bottoms, because the average person doesn't necessarily know what that is. But how did you get there? You were this sweet little girl growing up in Irvine, of all places, in Woodbridge, the safest city in America, when your dad was a preacher, and you, it sounds like a perfect life. How did that get so messed up?
Yeah, you know, I truly did have a really good childhood. I had great parents, supporting parents. I grew up in Irvine. I mean, you know, it was a beautiful place to grow up. And, you know, I met the people, and the people that I became friends with were drug addicts.
Mm.
Yeah.
And how many years was that? And how young were you when you started?
So the first time I started using alcohol, I was in seventh grade. Mm. So I started drinking in seventh grade, and then I found meth in eighth grade.
Wow.
So what is that? 14?
Gee. And you were how old when you finally quit?
So the first time I quit, it was 2 months before my 16th birthday.
So tell me, when we talked, you mentioned the first time that you quit drugs. There was something about a girl that you knew who found out you had a problem. Tell me about her.
Yeah. So word got around in high school that I got caught with drugs, not by the police, but by my parents. And she found out, and she saw me walking down the street one day, and she pulled over and she said, "Hey, I would like to take you to a recovery meeting." And I didn't know what she meant, but at that time I had no friends. All my friends didn't really want anything to do with me. And so I was like, whatever, a friend, I'll go, I'll do whatever. So she picked me up that week and took me to a meeting.
And you had not been using drugs for like 2 or 3 months before that, right?
Correct. My parents had sent me away to a family friend's house. And I was there for, I believe, a month and a half. And I came back and, I reached out to my friends and they weren't calling me back.
So let me get the picture though. In general, so while other kids in high school, the cheerleaders are out there with their pom-poms and kids are joining clubs and on sports teams, you're using drugs or you're going to recovery meetings. It doesn't sound, what, really?
I know. It's, I think about when I see a 15 or a 13-year-old kid, I can't imagine them doing drugs like I was. It just is so young. And my life, I was actually very blessed to get into recovery at a very young age. But yes, I was either doing drugs or I was in recovery. And I was in recovery for the last 2 years of my high school. So my junior and senior year, I was sober.
So you're going to meetings during the week with actually a bunch of other kids.
Yes.
And you were pretty close. You had like the high school group in a recovery meeting at a cool recovery club.
Yes.
Type thing. And then you guys all put your heads together and you thought you had a better idea than all these old people going to recovery meetings with you.
Yes.
What was that?
So I was actually very fortunate that I was able to find friends that were staying sober like I was and that were my age. That is incredible that I was able to find that. But once I graduated high school, I mean, I was so young when I got sober. So I really thought that there was this voice inside my head that said that it was just a phase, that I really wasn't an addict. Like everybody pictures an addict or an alcoholic being so much older. And, you know, here I was 18 years old and I had 2 years of sobriety. And I was just like, that had to be a phase. So me and five of my friends decided that we were going to go drink, because it was just a phase. We could do it normally. And we all went out and got a beer and cheers. And it didn't turn out the way I envisioned it.
What happened? So I'm picturing five kids. You're still illegal, right? Or I don't know. Was it drinking legal at 18?
No.
Who knows? 21. But anyway, for you, I haven't used drugs, alcohol, no big deal. So you're all having a beer, right?
Yeah.
And what happened? Did you have a second one?
Yeah, I had quite a few after that. You know, the what happens for a person like me and an alcoholic is the phenomenon of craving hits once you take that first drink. And what happened was definitely not something I planned. And within an hour, I was smoking meth. Within 7 days, I was homeless. Within 14 days, I was shooting meth and shooting heroin and back in a motel room.
And the other four, how did it work out for them?
The same. Yeah.
So you have a beer and then mm-hmm. you all go after your own drug of choice.
Correct. Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. We all ended up pretty beat up.
And so the one time when you started, I don't know if it's the same time, but you mentioned literally that in order to get out of that scene, your friends ended up kidnapping you. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, my best friend, her and I got sober. We met at 15. We had done the sobriety thing together. We were so close. We ended up getting, you know, relapsing, getting loaded together. And, you know, the second we got loaded, we kind of like went separate ways, and she ended up getting sober quickly before I did. And I called her from the motel room. And I usually blocked my number because I didn't want her to know where I was. And that, I mean, I was so out of my mind. I didn't block my number. So she called the number back, found out where I was. And three people from recovery came and kidnapped me from the hotel room and or motel room and took me to detox.
Mm. Is it really true you said that, like, when they brought you in, you literally could not see?
Yeah, I was so sick. I believe they weigh you and do all the physical stuff when you check into detox. And this was not a medical detox. So I didn't get the pleasure or comfort of that. So I did it cold turkey. And I remember on day 21 of detoxing that I could see. Like, I just remember, like, it felt like I could see color again. And it was, you know, I was pretty beaten up. I was 85 pounds when I checked in.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm guessing, Caitlin, and I really appreciate you being so honest that it can't be easy to be that vulnerable about that stuff. But I'm guessing that some of our listeners are probably parents and some may be active users themselves. So I'm wondering if they have a problem with drugs or alcohol, as well as the parents that have, you know, kids that may be struggling, adult kids or, you know, but they're sitting there saying, you know, if my kids did that, I'd kill them. I mean, you must have had some crazy liberal parents. I mean, it wouldn't happen in my house, right? What would you say to them?
Yeah, you know, my parents were definitely not liberal. They weren't the strictest parents, but I mean, they definitely wanted us to be free and to feel free. We moved to Irvine so that we could have that kind of life, that we could be free and they wouldn't have fear of something bad happening to us. So it's a very unexpected place for something like this to happen, but it could happen in any area. It does not matter where you live. It's drugs are found everywhere. And if a parent has a child or if they're questioning themselves, I mean, you can definitely reach out to help, go to a meeting, you know, reach out, tell somebody that you're struggling or you have questions. I mean, there's so many resources, especially in Orange County. This is the Mecca of, drug treatment. There's just so many resources here specifically.
So you ended up, and we were kind of skipping the part of the story, where you ended up becoming a trained drug and rehab, you know, specialist, and you were a counselor, and you actually sold for rehab companies. You would sell their services, and for hospitals, for people who would call from all over the country to say, what do I do? Does my insurance qualify? Where can you get me into? And I'm saying, but beneath all that, you've seen a lot now. Was there a secret sauce? Is the answer really go to a meeting?
There is no secret sauce. I do believe everybody's story is different. For me, I can only share with my story. And yes, I worked in the treatment industry for 10 years. I worked in every aspect of the drug and alcohol treatment center industry. And for me, I didn't go into treatment the first time. I just went to a meeting and I reached out for help.
Mm. Hey, Paul. I like to bring our producer, Paul.
Yes, sometimes. Absolutely.
Let us see your face here on our Zoom. You like this Zoom?
You're going to see me crying if you see Zoom my face radio. Here. It's a touching story here. Absolutely.
Yeah. So what
can, do you think can I ask you this? One question that occurs to me? I'm a parent, as John is. And we've had other people like yourself come on the show. And two questions. This is every parent's nightmare. What could your parents have done different? Not you, but is there anything your parents could have done to stop this?
No.
And that's the answer I hear all the time. We had a young man on our show a couple of years ago. We did a show on with a therapist, and she would bring some of her patients, and she did drug and alcohol treatment. And this young man, he said, my parents were nice to me. My parents were strict with me. My parents tried tough love. They tried no love. They tried everything they could think of. And he said, and I asked him the same question. He said, there's nothing they could have done. Once I tasted it, once I tried it, there's nothing anybody could have done. What a nightmare.
Yeah.
Because as a parent, you're there to protect your children. If something happens to your children, you blame yourself. And yet, here's something you have no control over. You put them in the safest environment in the world, and they get one access to this, the right person in front of the right drug, and you've got a never-ending spiral until they decide it's time to quit.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the heartbreaking thing about it, is that there is no way to help the person until they're ready to get help.
Yeah.
And, you know, my parents did the same thing. You know, they tried tough love. They tried love. They tried, you know,
sending you away, sending you, monitoring you, everything they could think of to do. Yeah.
Yeah. They tried everything and nothing would work. And, you know, they ended up reaching out to people in the recovery industry and, you know, trying to ask for help. And they're just like, stop. So, I mean, I feel like, and they did, they ended up, you know, not co-signing what I was doing. They didn't give me money. They took away everything. So yeah. it was difficult because they took away my car. They took away my phone. They took away everything. So, I mean, I do think that got me sober quicker, but that definitely wasn't the reason why I got sober.
So why'd you get sober?
I got sober. So this last time, 11 years ago. My sobriety date is June 27, 2009.
And I got to stop you for 1 second. Every addict or alcoholic I've met, my uncle was an alcoholic, can tell you the moment, the day they got sober for the rest of their life.
Yes. Yeah. And I feel like it's not a date that you choose. It's a life that you choose. Obviously, it's definitely when I was a little girl, I wasn't like, I want to be a drug addict when I grow up, you know?
Right.
I had bigger dreams than that. But yeah, so I was 11 years ago, over 11 years ago. It wasn't as crazy as the time before in the motel room. It was more of an emotional bottom, and you can have any kind of bottom. It doesn't have to be extreme. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to be shooting heroin in a motel. This last time, you know, it was an emotional bottom. I just could not stay sober. And I was so sick and tired of being sick and tired. Mm. And I just didn't want to feel the way I was feeling anymore. And I knew that I needed to do something different. And, you know, somebody once said to me, your best thinking got you to where you were. and it was time to listen to somebody else.
Boy, that's a powerful statement, because we rely on our own self, our brain, to help us, to save us, to guide us through. And when your brain can't help, when your brain is maybe even hurting, how do you let go?
Yeah, and that's where you know, reaching out for help is the key, and listening to somebody else.
The young man's story, who I'm thinking of, I wish I could remember his name, but it was a powerful, as is this, a very powerful, vulnerable tale told that I'll never forget. I forgot his name, but I'll never forget the story. And he said, same thing, he grew up somewhere here in affluent Orange County and went through everything. His parents tried everything and nothing worked. He was in and out of jail. He was homeless. He was in motels. He was all this kind of stuff. And he said, finally, he said it was a stranger at one of the 8,000 rehab things he was at who simply went up to him and said, "You're better than this." And he said that so touched him at that moment that some stranger cared. It didn't matter that his mom and dad cared and his sisters and cared and his friends cared and everybody else cared. He could ignore all that. But some stranger just touched him in a way that just struck him. And so the third question I ask is, why are so many who've gone through this hell committed to helping others? I would think you'd run so far away from me, you wouldn't ever want to see or talk or admit it. I'm never going to and I don't want to hear about it anymore here.
Yeah. I feel like because once you experience something like that, you experience the pain, you experience the loss, you experience, I mean, for me, it was just so painful that if I can offer a little bit of help or a little bit of faith to somebody that it will get better, I love doing that. I mean, how could I not? How could I deny that of somebody when that was so freely given to me?
Because it hurts even to think about it, and you don't ever want to think about it again. Yeah, I can come up with about 100 reasons I wouldn't give it to somebody else. I wouldn't give it another thought.
Hey, yeah. Paul, let's get to the rest of the story. Yes. You're the producer. How much time we have?
As much time as you need.
I tell you what. I go to where we began 11 years and a few months ago. Could you imagine what your life is like now? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, people just saying, "Oh, another preacher's kid." Yeah, you're just reacting.
Well, what is her life now? You got to tell everybody what her life is now. Yeah, tell us where you're at
Fill
today.
Yeah. So, you know, through working the recovery program and being honest with myself and not going back to using drugs and alcohol, you know, my life did slowly get better. It was a slow process, though. If you are trying to get sober now and you're like, this pain or how tough life is doesn't feel like it's ever going to end, it does. Everybody's story is so different. And for me, I have an amazing husband. We were friends before we started dating, and we just have the most, you know, honest, loving, caring relationship. And we just had a baby girl in December.
Wow,
so she's 8 months old now.
Hopefully you gave her another Irish name here.
Her name is Cooper.
Cooper.
Yeah. And, you know, the relationship we have is just is an example of the recovery. And we wouldn't have what we have today if it weren't for.
How did he accept your past? I would think many would run, thinking it might reoccur.
If I lie to myself about what was real, I could never move forward.
You're saying,
how did he accept it? So you meet somebody and he knows this story. I would think most would run once you told them that story.
Well, lucky for me, he has a similar story.
Ah,
yeah.
A little sympathy here. Okay.
Yeah. So we met in recovery.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, you see me all emotional if people who end up watching this on YouTube. I guess we had a.
Is it time for the great reveal here?
Yeah.
I don't think anybody who's listened to your questions has any doubt that this is your daughter.
Oh, yeah. I call her Chicky, and that's politically incorrect. next time, Kate, next time we do the show together, we're going to start out with the time you said, "Hey, Dad, you have a problem too."
Yeah.
Yes. So, yeah. Yes, we will.
Let me just wrap up with a few words. And thanks so much, Kate, for coming in. And yes, you do have an amazing husband and a perfect child who will continue to be perfect until she figures out that she's a lot like you. Mm-hmm. Before we go.
I'm scared.
Yeah, and you should be.
I know.
A few words about church and people. You notice we didn't talk a lot about church today. Being a preacher's kid and going to church wasn't enough to keep Caitlin away from drugs. In many recovery groups, they talk about drugs and alcohol as being cunning, baffling, and powerful. Sometimes we think church should be like a vaccine to the evils of this world. It isn't, and it can hurt. We think it should be. It's interesting to me that while church doesn't keep people from any of the evils in the world they wish it would, the beginning of any good recovery program starts by acknowledging that we don't do it very well in life when we try to play God. As Caitlin said, her plan wasn't working so well. We don't have to go to church to do that, but sometimes it helps. In the 1930s and 40s, when the modern recovery movement began, clergy were some of the earliest adopters and close confidants of the leaders. The Bible was a key resource readily quoted from and used in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, often without giving it any credit. Meeting rooms were most often found in basements of churches, given freely or at a minimal cost to those seeking help. No doubt some religious folk thought simple repentance and a strong will should be all an addict needed. Centuries of drunkenness and addiction have proved otherwise, but we can be slow learners. For today, I'm glad you got to meet a recovering addict and to hear a bit of her story. 5 years ago today, her brother dove off a boat and instantaneously became a quadriplegic. So in the next day or two, we're going to have dinner together and toast recovery and celebrate with two people who were at the top of my list for most respected in life, son and daughter. Life is weird, and God is good. Sure don't like his plan sometimes, but I love his ands. Church hurts, and it's worth the thought. This is John Bash. Love somebody today, won't you? And enjoy God.
Wow. And that brings us to the close of another emotional edition of Church Hurts And, with a lot to think about and a lot to be hopeful for. We hope that you'll come back each and every week. And we hope you'll pick up a phone or an email and continue the conversation with our host, Dr. John Bash. He's a shepherd with Standing Stone. He's still standing after a lot of stones have been thrown at him. It's a nonprofit ministry committed to caring for pastors who need help. If you'd like to find out more about what we're all about, churchhurtsand.org is the place for you to check in. And if you want to add your story to those amazing tales we continue to tell, reach out. We'll talk. See you next time. Right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net. We'll be right back.